This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pograin Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Creating Page Turner's Protagonists.
Hearst Architect Julia Morgan.
Tristan Zimmerman and Ballad Hunters.
And Sun Records Cuba Diplomacy.
Big news from Mission Control. If you missed out the first time, don't panic. The wait is over. The Catstronauts board game is finally back in stock at Atlas Games.
That's right. Catstronauts sold out almost immediately on release, but the reprint has officially landed. Now you can finally bring the kitty crew home to your tabletop.
And just in time, too, because things are getting interesting on the International Space Station.
Giant laser pointers in space and a live stream of nose boops? What's not to like? Let's check out how the Catstronauts are doing up there.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Careful, Waffles. If the other Catstronauts catch you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, it's back to litter box duty for you.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady, Pom Pom is swatting at fasteners like feather toys, and Major Meowser is... napping on the instructions.
Teamwork at its finest. You can lead this kitty crew yourself in the official Catstronauts board game.
It's a cooperative challenge featuring pawsome art by the comics creator Drew Brockington, and it's perfect for gamers of all ages.
But remember, the first printing disappeared at light speed. Don't let this reprint of Catstronauts slip through your claws.
Secure your copy today at atlas-games.com/catstronauts. That's atlas-games.com/catstronauts. The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the gaming hut. And as previously, we're having the gaming hut not in the old billiard room, the den, the romper room down in the basement. We seem to be having it in a room lined with books. It might be Mom's Nook, might be the church after church services, but there's a lot of improving literature on the walls because once more we're talking page turners, Robin's wonderful new drama system 1-to-1 in which you play tales torn, not literally torn, that's terrible, copied down in your fine hand from works of literature and drama. And Robin, since this is your baby, why don't you carry him around the house cooing?
Right. So, yes, this is for Page Turners, the game of interpersonal drama for one GM and one player. It features scenarios by me and by Sarah Sam, Saltiel, Wade Rocket, and Ruth Tillman. And it is available now from the Pellegrin web store. You can pause this episode even as we speak and order it and make sure that you get it for you and someone else who enjoys very intense personal drama. So what is at the center of any dramatic narrative or any intense story of emotion or intensely funny story, as some of the genres in the book allow for? Well, that is a protagonist, a character that the player plays, latches onto, and drives the action by pursuing their unmet needs. And so this time around, I thought we talked a little bit, the last time we talked about page turners, about creating your own scenarios. The scenario material for this needs to be somewhat more elaborate than, for example, multiplayer drama system, which can just sort of be a series of notes and basic ideas. But you have to have more to latch onto because you have less time, whether you're the player or the GM, to think about things off screen because you're on screen the whole time. So the object of the scenarios is to give the player and GM alike lots and lots of material, and you're going to as you play it, you're going to draw on maybe 10% of it, 15% of it, and you're going to take the narrative in a direction that you do not necessarily expect it to go, but you have to have something to start with. And that something, as I said, is the main character. So what we're going to do here as an exercise in scenario writing is the first step of writing a page turner scenario which is coming up with the main character. So Ken, you're going to surprise me with a genre, and we're going to start kicking around ideas for what the protagonist might be. Before you start, one last proviso, which is that very often, not always, the scenario will present a choice of two or possibly three protagonists that they can select from. And in general, the other possible protagonists then become the supporting characters, among others, that they interact with. So I suppose at some point someone might write a scenario where you just pick one of the protagonists and the other two just never appear. But for the moment, all of the setup is that they also remain in the narrative. So, for example, in The Beacon, which is the Fitzgerald pastiche, you can choose to be either the husband or the wife in a couple of discontented people who are then drawn into the vortex of wealth through their next door neighbor. And so, Ken, what genre or narrative convention or tradition are we going to create a protagonist or protagonists for?
I thought we would go in the direction of the school story, the Smith stories by Woodhouse, Stalky and Company by Kipling. I think probably Enid Blyton wrote a bunch of them, though I haven't read any of them, but I'm sure they're all there somewhere. And then I guess the flip side of that is the school story more told from the teacher perspective, Goodbye, Mr. Chips, or the middle bit of The Spy Who Came In from the Cold. Lots of drama and potential drama there. And of course, if you add a bunch of vulgar magic to it, it becomes Harry Potter, but we don't have to do that because the school story that Harry Potter nerd tropes is itself, I think, a pretty interesting sort of a hothouse environment for the production of drama. So, or the production of comedy, again, as in the Smith stories and to an extent the Stalky and Company stories. So that's my subgenre, the school story.
So the first thing we want to ask ourselves is what unites protagonists from the genre? What does the player, when you've convinced them to do a school story, what are they expecting to bring to the table? What do they think their character is going to do? What do they think their character's emotional drive is going to be? And the obvious thing in a school story is the desire to perhaps initially prove yourself, but also school stories are, I think, typically about finding a community. And also that means in the context of this genre, I think defining not only who is your community, but who is your anti-community? Who do you distance yourself from? Who do you worry about? And so are we going to have sort of a classic outsider character who has something to prove? And are we going to create at least one protagonist, Ken, where the class structure is playing into that? So the reason that our character is an outsider is possibly that they're a scholarship student, and therefore they are not part of the usual community and are going to have to kind of elbow their way in.
Right. Yeah. I think that that's the sort of the classic version. And in the old days, people would expect this to be a sports story, that the scholarship kid turns out to be really good at cricket, and that's how he wins the love and acceptance of his fellows. In the sort of second generation, the Kipling and Woodhouse era, then they win acclaim by being good at pranks and good at schemes, good at stalks, as Stalky is, putting one over either on the rival students or over on the masters and getting away with less homework or getting away with extra food from the refectory or whatever the sort of the low stakes score happens to be. And their mastery at low cunning in this case, or even, you know, high cunning, is what brings their ragtag team together, sort of like, you know, Danny Ocean recruiting his crew. That's sort of the other arc of these sorts of stories. So I think, yeah, beginning with the scholarship kid makes the most sense. People will be able to sort of identify with that, certainly in this modern era, and then sort of decide, are we doing a sports story? Are we doing a scheming story, a stalking story? Or are we doing a more conventional sort of a God forbid, Tom Brown school days where it's just Christian pluck that makes him beloved, which I think is maybe not quite the arc that you want to try selling gamers on in this year of our Lord 2026.
Right. So I think this character, if we're going to make this a dramatic, serious version, is also going to have an internal flaw that they are going to have to overcome, because otherwise you just essentially have melodrama where the good underdog wins over the initially untrusting overdogs.
As in Tom Brown's School Days.
Right. Which is, by contemporary standards, also weird too, because it's like, well, why do you even want that, right? Yeah. So what would that thing possibly be? One of them, I think, could be anger and resentment, right? That he, our lead character, has a desire to sort of initially overcome and show them and give them what for, and is perhaps somewhat maladroit, perhaps a bit too much of a rebel, and has to learn, first of all, that they even want to be part of a community. So that could be one thing that we can suggest in the background and backstory. And so one question then to answer would be, why does this character need a community in the first place? So is there an issue with their family where they are alienated from their family? They're possibly the black sheep there. Or do they, you know, sort of in classic boys' story fashion, is this an orphan or an only child, or have some other reason for them to especially need community to sort of heighten that desire? So it goes beyond what the ordinary person could be. Could be that they were schooled by their parents as missionaries and have had little experience with the home country. So we could come up with all sorts of different reasons. Which one of those do you think is the strongest that the most people might want to play out?
Before we run pell-mell down the drama corridor, I'd like to take just a peek down the more comedic scheming corridor and ask what are the core elements of that sort of character as well, because you can still have the need for community as a hole that must be filled, certainly, and a pride in their own background, like the kid might be Welsh, or in the Great Brain stories, the kid is Catholic, not Mormon, and so all the other kids think ill of him. And so there's often that sort of outsider vibe, even amongst the comic type of school story. So where would we go? We would still identify a need for community. That's, both of them are the same thing, because as you suggest, the story's about assembling the community through a series of actions, be they cricket games or pranks.
Right. Because the difference between a tragic or serious story and a comic story is not the motivations, but the consequences and the tone. So all of those motivations previously cited in the serious one, and even the idea of a flaw, could be part of a comic character, because it's very common for a trickster character to themselves be susceptible to being tricked, because otherwise that character becomes cruel very quickly. And so you need moments where a sort of a picaresque character classically goes up and down in fortune. And it could very well be that their rival, and the sort of the leader of the rival group of boys who is usually in charge of the pranks, could very well be essentially a more perfect and therefore completely annoying mirror image of you. And so I think particularly if the vehicle by which you achieve acceptance is pranks and not sports, a putatively constructive thing, that you are going to focus even more on the rivals and enjoying turning them on their head. So you have to, again, figure out as we develop our protagonist, what are the opposites or the annoying mirror characters that you're going to react against. And so again, in the biography, you're going to probably suggest that. So it could well be that I think in that instance, you probably don't want them to be a total outsider to the school system. Maybe they've started a new school and the backstory is, you know, what happened at the old school and what their relationships with people are and what mistakes that they don't want to repeat. And so that would also be part of the backstory that the player can then use as emotional fuel to explain why they're going out and seeking allies and seeking to overturn the fortunes of their chosen rivals.
Yeah, I sort of want to gesture at on the way by, not really talk about, because most dark academia, there's a strong procedural component, because they're usually solving a mystery as well as doing whatever else is going on. But the drama there is usually a standard coming of age drama where they begin callow in some fashion. Either they think they're a rebel, but they have to understand, you know, what the point of that is, or they begin isolated and they have to make romantic partners as well as friends. But that sort of callowness is the usual flaw in a dark academia character. So going back to the conventional school story, I think you're on the right track with the notion of either the flaw being you're closed off socially and you are working to fix that, maybe against your will you're working to fix that, the flaw of being a rebel, or as you flip it, susceptible to the sort of chaos that you engender. And then, which is again, a thing that rebels certainly, you know, they cause a problem and they're the ones who get the demerits or get expelled. And then the dark secret, the what happened at your old school there, that can of course apply to, you know, either of those things that, you know, depending on how dark you wanted it to go, you know, something really bad could have happened, or you were just sent down because you were too much of a scapegrace. And now you're pledging not to be caught this time. But of course, you have to navigate the new school in order to, you know, win your imaginary revenge on the school system.
So the main thing then that you would write into the description of the protagonist is what lesson they're going to learn in a coming of age story, right? That's a coming of age story is wisdom is acquired at the end, and either they acquire wisdom or you never see this, but I bet it'll come up if you let a player do it sometimes, or that they, you know, hold fast to their ignorance and have sort of a low consequence school version of a tragedy where you achieve social doom, if not a literal doom, by failing to create your community, of having everybody turn on you. And so that could then be the, if there's a question of suspense as to the outcome at all, if you allow an ambiguous or doomed ending as opposed to always going toward union and overcoming your flaw and acquiring wisdom, somewhere implicit in your description will be a description of what wisdom is. And that could be that, so if you describe, you know, you are driven by a desire to win at all costs, and this is sometimes cost you friends, that is an implicit way of signaling to the player, and this is the story in which you learn to let others win. Or Right. You have always felt socially awkward and withdrawn, and so your way of acquiring wisdom implicitly is, and then you open up. Or you have always been distrustful of other people, but in the big cricket match or the school play or whatever it is, at the end, you learn to trust someone who you previously distrusted, and that gives you the wisdom you need to achieve union at the end. And of course, you would then take these concepts and describe them in concrete terms, in terms of you'd give the character a name and a biography, and you would describe their emotional state, and then the player can take this description and go in whatever number of directions with it. And the way that they would achieve that in play is by calling scenes with the other characters in the school. And so in a segment later on, we will then flesh this out a bit and come up with the different characters that one might meet if you're playing the protagonist in a school story. But for the moment, let's consider ourselves completely schooled, except in the topic of this upcoming Hut and/or segment.
Moving drama.
Hilarious comedy.
And you are the sole protagonist.
Page Turners is my game of personal storytelling for one player and one GM.
Coming in February from Pelgrane Press.
Longtime listeners know Hillfolk, my game of dramatic group play.
Winner of the coveted Diana Jones Award.
Page Turners shifts its dynamic down to the intimate scale of a single main character whose fiction you weave on the fly with one other creator.
Shockingly simple rules keep the focus on emotional interaction.
Extensive guidance helps you shape satisfying outcomes.
Writers Sarah Sam Saltiel, Wade Rocket, and Ruth Tillman join Robin in presenting 11 scenarios spanning a wealth of genres and tones.
Scenarios include
Jazz Age Ambition and Glamour,
A Childhood Haunted by Strife and a Shadowy Being,
Deceit and Survival on the Spaceship Earth Again,
A Stay in Bath takes an unexpected turn in the Austen-inspired Entreaty and Entanglement,
The screwball 30s hijinks of Loose Screws.
The Shakespearean comedy of Love's Loyal Laborers.
A love triangle unfolding from the turbulent 60s to the troubled 20-teens.
Behind the music drama in the LA punk scene.
The arrival of a telepathic stranger on a spacebound way station.
Tragic love between a vampire and a mortal.
And an epic multi-generational saga of artificial beings attempting to build a civilization in the tradition of that extinct species, Homo sapiens.
Gorgeously laid out and illustrated by graphic superstar Jen McCleary.
Whoever you want to be, wherever your imagination takes you.
Whether your journey leads to union doom or something harder to define.
Page Turners unleashes your story in new and unexpected ways.
The balustrades, the buttresses, the columns. All of these architectural elements tell us that we're once more, yes, in that most elaborate of huts, the best built one, perhaps one where the final hut did not match the production sketches. It's the architecture hut. And Ken, this time around, a beloved Patreon backer, Charles Picard, asks, where and why might we encounter architect Julia Morgan in our games? Notably, she was in Paris in 1896, cramming for her École des Beaux-Arts entrance exam. Just stepping off a train in Santa Barbara when it was leveled by an earthquake in 1925, and the main architect for William Randolph Hearst's San Simeon for decades. That's a lot to unpack, but Ken, you've done your research, and you're unpacking.
Yeah, Charles kindly has basically answered his own question for us, but let's see if we can answer it at length. Julia Morgan, born in 1872 in San Francisco, she is from sort of upper class stock. Her mother is the daughter of a millionaire. Her dad is a serial entrepreneur, which means he is supported by a millionaire, the in-laws. And she has a sort of a highfalutin childhood. At one point, when she's a child, in fact, she meets the architect Pierre Lebrun, who is married to her older cousin, and she is inspired by him. And that is what drives her first to go to school, which many young women of quality did not feel the need to do in the 1880s and 90s, but also to pursue architecture. And so she goes to Berkeley, one of the first women to matriculate from Berkeley at all, and one of the only women to matriculate from Berkeley with a degree in civil engineering. This is in 1894. Berkeley at that time had no architecture degree, so that's the closest she could get. She had to train as a lowly engineer. At Berkeley, she is taught and then begins a friendship with the architect Bernard Maybeck. Maybeck had gone to the Beaux-Arts and overlapped with Chambers, so if you're looking for a tie-in there, there's one. She moves, as Charles notes, to Paris in 1896. She's cramming for Beaux-Arts admission. Beaux-Arts, of course, are a bunch of crummy sexists. The Academy Julian used to admit women, but Beaux-Arts, not so much.
Right. And the Academy Julian is like the rough kids art school. It would be, right. It might admit women, but it would pose an entirely different set of challenges.
Yes. And she crams 1 year and they give her the test and say, nope, you failed. And she says, show me the test. They say, oh, we lost it. So then she goes and crams again and does another year and goes and takes the test and insists on seeing a copy of her test. And she says, what's this minus 100 at the end? And they said, oh, that's for being a girl. We're just taking that off already. Girls can't architect. Everyone knows it. So there's a standard minus 100.
Yeah, usually that's written in invisible ink.
Right. Well, not at the Beaux-Arts, by God, yeah. Or at least not after the second test. So then she crams again. This is incredibly eager to go to the Beaux-Arts and incredibly self-willed. And so she goes and this time insists on a test before the whole panel of the architecture faculty. And with them watching, she answers every question. She does a terrific job. By now, she's studied for 3 years for this stupid test. And they are forced to admit her. And so she is admitted in 1899. And then they say, well, you're going to age out of the Beaux-Arts. You can't keep going for the full 6 year career, the full 6 year load at Beaux-Arts. And she says, all right, I'll do it in 3, and gets out in 1902. So quite a character already, even in this Yellow King era, moves back to San Francisco. begins working for various Hearst family projects. Being the daughter of millionaires, she has some connections. She gets her architecture license and opens up a private firm in 1904. And one of her first non-Hearst clients is Mills College in Oakland, and they want a bell tower. So she puts up a bell tower, and in 1906, it does not fall down along with every other tower in the Bay Area, and her career takes off because people are very excited that her techniques, and I guess this is where that engineering background comes in handy, don't knock the buildings over. So she is put to rebuilding the Fairmont Hotel. She doesn't get to design it, but she does get in charge of rebuilding it, which is a very plum thing. And then that's in 1907. In 1914, she builds the LA Examiner building. Again, this is for Hearst. And in 1919, Hearst, having tried her out on these various other jobs, says, I feel like you're the person who understands my needs for San Simeon, for Hearst Castle. And she says, I sure do. And primary among his needs are to come in and annoy the architect with new additions to the plans. So some of the rooms in Hearst Castle, you can see where there was a finished design. And then Hearst said, oh, did I say I wanted the pool to be 100 feet long? I meant 150 feet long. And then she has to tear it out and rebuild it. So Hearst and Morgan, and this is another one of her incredible gifts as a person, she meets all of her clients personally. She never fobs anyone off with a draftsman or whatever. She doesn't take remote clients except very, very rarely. And with Hearst comes and he gives her some new dumb idea, and she says, right away, Mr. Hearst, here's what it's going to cost to do that.
Yeah, and will this says, extend the project and my paycheck? Okay, I guess.
But she's cool about it, unlike, say, Mr. Wright, who would not be cool about this kind of behavior. And so Hearst is happy to keep writing checks, and she continues to design Hearst Castle. And by now, she has sort of grown into her art style, which is very eclectic American Beaux-Arts. So she will design a Moorish Gothic palace for one client. She will design a Renaissance villa for another client. She is capable of taking sort of the best architectural traditions that she knows about, and then following Wright and his school, apply them to the land that the building will sit on. So it's not just plopping it down and flattening the area. Now, if there's a hill, she puts it, you know, in relationship, in conversation with the hill. So she is marrying the best of the old architecture and the best of the new architecture in her designs. All right. So in 1925, as Charles has foretold, she arrives in Santa Barbara. She's been hired to design a professional women's hotel. This is the Margaret Baylor Inn. Obviously, it used to be that if you're a professional woman, you couldn't just check into a random old hotel. There might be men there, Robin, and we all know about men. So they had to have special hotels for professional women to stay at, and this is one of them. And as she steps off the train, June 29th, 1925, Santa Barbara convulses in an earthquake and the whole town is knocked down. I was not immediately researching how much of Santa Barbara she was hired to rebuild, but she certainly got the Margaret Baylor Inn put up, so good for her. In 1927, she designs the Point Lobos Marine Exchange Lookout, which is kind of a watchtower type building for looking out over the sea. And then you would call down to the stock exchange and say, here's the ship that's come in. And this is an octagon house from episode 80. And at least one other house that she has designed has no right angles because the client claims his wife hated them. And that is all I could find out about that other house. But I don't think that we need to tell anyone listening that that client is either a Hound of Tyndalos or a vampire or something magic going on. Because when the client shows up and says, oh, my wife hates right angles, don't put them in the house, that triggers the old spidey sense. Anyway, she also, speaking of the undead, redesigns and expands the columbarium at Mountain View Cemetery. The columbarium is called the Chapel of the Chimes, and she's doing this in 27-28.
And incidentally, this is the final resting place of iconic blues man John Lee Hooker.
Yeah.
Which is a pure digression. I don't think that has anything to do with anything.
But it's good fun. She does a lot of work for the YWCA over her career, and the YWCA Chinatown building incorporates feng shui and Chinese decorative and ritual motifs. And this is in 1932, and she waives her fee for it, which is an interesting sidelight, and maybe you want to tie her into some sort of cool 1930s feng shui game going on. 1951, she retires with over 700 buildings in total built or designed by her. Most of them are in the Bay Area. She doesn't seem to have had a lot of clients outside it, but as, you know, you heard from the word earthquake, you know, it's a town that keeps needing buildings. So she's famous and beloved and dies in 1957 in San Francisco after a long and beautiful, I would say, career.
Right. So when there's an architect and you're wondering whether their time in Paris in the 1890s led to, for example, a brush with Carcosa, if eerie events followed her around, the natural thing that you ask yourself is how many of the buildings that she designed are haunted. And of course, the way that we tell if buildings are haunted is we look on the internet, and people who run ghost tours in almost every city typically will find out that the most picturesque buildings that you can go into on a tour tend to be haunted. So this is 100% reliable. So the Hotel Fairmount is one of San Francisco's most haunted buildings, and it's primarily haunted, though, by the friendly ghosts of its two founders, the daughters of the silver magnate James Fair, who named their hotel in their father's honor. But it's not just them. You've got your classic Lady in Red ghost. That, of course, is a saucy ghost who can sometimes be found lying on your bed when you check into the room and then vanishes, which is either delightful or unnerving, depending on how you feel about ghost ladies. There's a top-hatted ghost, and of course, the usual cold spots and voices. The bell tower at Mills College. Mills College is very haunted, but the bell tower itself only has one measly ghost incident where someone reported running into ghost Jesuits. But that, again, there's a bit of Carcosa to that.
Yeah.
Hearst Castle, you'll be glad to know, also has ghosts. The pool surrounding that, one hears the sounds of laughter and people frolicking and splashing. And when you turn the lights on, it all stops. Some people have reported the sound of Hearst's voice reassuring Marion Davies, which is a thing he probably had to do a lot. And there also is one report of a tourist who was pinched on the behind by a discarnate entity. And if you think getting Me Too charges to stick against flesh and blood people is difficult, taking a sexual harassment charge against a ghost, that's very, very challenging. And then finally, in Julia Morgan House, which is a residence in Sacramento, one hears children crying. Again, a specter in a top hat. I don't know if it's the same top-hatted ghost as the Fairmount. Maybe he goes back and forth due to some sort of connection to Julia Morgan and just a general sense of eerie presence. And the YWCA Chinatown, they say, well, they have vibes there, but I don't think vibes quite qualify. Although perhaps if it weren't designed with proper feng shui, it would have, you know, even worse ghost problems. So maybe that's
right. Yeah.
Her design at work there.
I think the vibes are probably the demons trying to haunt it and slipping away.
Exactly. So my main question then would be where she developed her affinity for earthquakes, because at a couple of key points in her career, earthquakes really come through for her. So right. Is that something that happens in Paris? Is there a Carcosan connection to an egregore of the earth? Or perhaps is that something that happens at home in the Bay Area, since that's where the earthquakes are? Is that an affinity that is reached before the brush with Carcosa and somehow offers a protection against it? What do you think, Ken?
I think that there is a possibility, and I just threw this out there, that she, at some point in her childhood, maybe under the influence of one of these weird millionaires, promised herself to the god Poseidon. And said, you know what? Men are terrible. I'm going to marry Poseidon. And she does so in a ceremony of some sort, possibly led there by one of her mom's millionaire friends or by someone at Berkeley, because Poseidon is the god of earthquakes. She doesn't take a lot of sea voyages, but I feel like that sort of drive that she has and ability to sort of, you know, stay on her own two feet throughout this very, very difficult career that she's mastered implies some sort of divine protection or connection. And Poseidon being the god of earthquakes, I think he's a great choice. And also, it adds a sort of a classical note to her. She never married, and nothing is known about her romantic life pretty much at all. So could it be Poseidon? Could be. Don't know. But yeah, I think that there's definitely some sort of earthquake marriage going on, or earthquake connection. And again, I think that the Tim Powersness of going around California with magical earthquakes means it's probably some sort of a marital connection or romantic connection with a god.
And it could be sort of a paper mystical marriage, one of affinity rather than a romantic relationship as well. Because I think...
Well, I mean, obviously Poseidon's not going to like move into a two flat in Berkeley. He's going to be like, yeah, absolutely. No, we'll maintain our own households.
Yeah. And if you think dudes are a problem, a male Greek god is perhaps not your refuge there.
Well, but again, that's the great thing about marrying Poseidon. He's got, you know, he's got a wife and kids somewhere else. He's not going to be pestering you on the weekends.
He's got a whole ocean to swim around in. He's just going to, it's just one of those Greek green card mystical marriages. Well, right. On that note, I think it's time for us to see what segment, hot, or perhaps even special guest awaits us on the other side of this here commercial. In the Spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's Eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's Breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's Law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's Light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Protect this podcast from earthquakes and cash crunches by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Mark Kenny,
Neil Kaplan,
Oren Gushuri,
Paul and Cleo Bushland,
and Michael Kuehl. It's time once again for Ken and or Robin talk to someone else. And this time around, this is Robin talking to the brilliant designer, Tristan Zimmerman, who is going to tell us about Ballad Hunters, which Pelgrane Press is kickstarting in March. So, hey, Tristan, thank you for joining us, first of all.
No, thank you so much for having me back, Robin. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I disagree with your characterization of me.
Okay, so you're trying to go for honorary Canadian status, and I won't have it. So prove yourself wrong, Tristan, by telling us in Ballad Hunters, who do we, the players, play, and what do we do?
So it's 1813, England and Scotland. You play as amateur folklorists working in service to the crown, because where people sing the folk ballads of England and Scotland, sometimes these songs are coming to life and people are feeling compelled, supernaturally compelled, to take on a role from the song and do in real life what that character did in the song. And that's a problem because these are songs songs of grief, of betrayal, of murder, of true love, of ghosts and fairies. And these songs tend to end very badly for the characters in them. So where people are acting out these songs, it typically is going to go badly. And your characters show up in places where these songs are going to come to life. And you need to help people. You need to get people through the song alive, through the song intact. And you do this by really digging into the lyrics of the particular song that has come to life, anticipating what's going to happen before it happens, trying to help people, trying to keep people safe, using textual analysis, looking for clues, and with the help of a little bit of ballad magic.
So the thing about Ballad Hunters, as listeners just heard, is that the premise is very specific. So how did you come to this? How did Ballad Hunters come to be?
So longtime listeners of the show may remember that I appeared back in 2022 or 2021 talking about Shanty Hunters, which is a very similar premise, but it's about sea shanties in the year 1880. And I had long wanted to do a role-playing game about, hey, songs come into life. Oh, no, this causes problems. Oh, why is it never the good songs that come to life? Why is it only ever the bad songs? And I did Shanty Hunters first because people were, very interested in and excited in sea shanties. But
that was during shanty fever.
Yeah, that was actually not even intentional. But yes, it was during shanty fever.
Well, and the trick to exploiting shanty fever is to just be slightly ahead of the curve.
Yes. But I actually wanted to do Ballad Hunters well before I ever attempted Shanty Hunters. And the deal with these traditional English and Scottish ballads, they're called child ballads, not because they are songs for children, they are not, but because they were compiled in the late 1800s by a Harvard folklorist by the name of Francis James Child. And these child ballads are incredibly gameable, right? These are rich and evocative stories that just lend themselves to great adventures at the table. So Shanty Hunters was kind of a dry run for me trying this out. It won an Ennie Award, a Judge's Choice, which was fantastic, and also kind of, I think, proved the concept to a certain extent. And then I got to iterate on that same concept with Ballad Hunters, and in particular introducing this new mechanic, which is kind of the mechanic that playtesters consistently walk away from the game saying, like, oh my God, this was the heart of the game. And that mechanic is what's called the compass verse, which lets every character, every investigator in the game has access to a little bit of ballad magic, a single verse from a different ballad, and they can make that verse come to life. And it, in a certain sense, is like a story game prompt, right? It's, you're doing investigative gumshoe adventures. This is a gumshoe game. I guess I haven't mentioned that so far, but you're doing an investigative gumshoe adventure. And then every so often, somebody can slap down on the table what essentially amounts to a story game prompt saying, well, I have my compass verse. This is what my verse is. I'm going to make it come to life. This is what I think that looks like. This is how I think that's going to help us in this circumstance. This is how I think it's going to help us deal with the problems that we are currently facing, as, you know, the metaphors and the imagery from the song that's coming to life are manifesting in ways that are stopping us, blocking us from helping people. And the GM still gets kind of veto authority over, I don't think what you're doing with your compass verse here makes sense or works. But in practice, that basically never, ever happens.
And more often you would adjust the suggestion rather than shoot it down.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And there's advice on how to handle all this in the book. But yeah, so Ballad Hunters takes this new compass verse mechanic, integrates it into the game, takes a different folkloric tradition and integrates it into the game. And I think what you get is just this really, really wonderful experience.
So one of the things about Ballad Hunters is it sort of has a rich number of compelling, unique elements. And that means we haven't even yet talked about what I think most people will take away from a session, especially one run by you, is in addition to the compass verses, There's a sing-along aspect. So how does that work?
Yeah, so I'm a big fan of singing together in groups. I have been singing with other people for, 15 years at this point. It's wonderful. It's magical. One of the great things about singing folk songs is it doesn't kind of matter whether you're any good, right? These are ordinary songs for and by ordinary people. It's not opera. And so if you're going to be playing an adventure about a particular song coming to life, and you're around the table with your friends, yeah, man, sing the song around the table with your friends. It's not a requirement. You don't have to do it in order to play the game, but just, God, why wouldn't you?
And at what point does the singing happen? Is it at the end? Is it partway through?
So the singing usually happens about a quarter or a third of the way into the session, and that feels like a great time to mention. The adventures for Ballad Hunters are much shorter than for most other Gumshoe games. Usually an adventure is about 2 to 3 hours long, and that's very intentional, and everything about the game is kind of structured for this tight 2 to 3 hour experience. And usually you sing the song, you know, a quarter or a third of the way into that 2 to 3 hour adventure. Generally, your investigators show up in this environment where you know that a ballad is going to come to life, but you don't necessarily know which one. You kind of poke around, you realize, oh man, ain't it always the case that these ballads never come to life in you know, boring places? There's always something interesting, something compelling, something complicated happening in the place where you have arrived. Maybe you get a chance to start figuring out what's up with that. And then somebody sings a child ballad. And when an NPC, a GMC, excuse me, sings a child ballad, that's the ballad that's going to come to life. And that's the point where you kind of pass out the lyrics handouts to everyone. And if you are singing around the table with your friends, which I cannot recommend highly enough that you do, like, you should do this. It's a huge amount of fun. That's when you then sing it. And then those lyrics handouts are largely your core clues for the rest of the adventure, because that's the story that these GMCs are going to be acting out. And so because you have the lyrics in front of you, you know what's going to happen before it happens and can try to take steps to mitigate it. And then also, as I mentioned, the metaphors, the imagery present in these songs, they manifest in the game world and cause problems for you. And so players get to kind of pore over the sheet of paper when they encounter something weird in the game, and you pore over your lyrics and you say, wait a minute, I see what's going on. This is, this is a reference to the first verse of the song where it says, you know, 'twas in about Martinmas time when green leaves were a-falling. You know, look, the problem that we're dealing with right now is we need some leaves, but the leaves are falling, and let's look for solutions to this problem in the lyrics of the game. And so that's where you're having your lyrics hand out in front of you really makes the experience. And if you have sung the ballad, then you have already begun to engage with the lyrics, and ain't that great?
So Palgrain publisher Kat Tobin acquired Ballad Hunters before I came on board as creative director. And as I looked at it, I said, this has got to be the beginning of a new line, specifically the line I'm calling the Gumshoe Labs line, which basically is marking the fact that this diverges so far from the baseline version of Gumshoe that we've seen in other games like Trail of Cthulhu or the Esoterras or Knights Black Agents. It is, you've drifted it considerably in another direction. And I think that's great because it shows how much you can do with the core elements of Gumshoe. So how specifically does it diverge from the Gumshoe people know?
So the biggest thing, the thing that's immediately going to strike you when you sit down to play this game and you start making your character, or you pick up one of the pregens, is you will notice that abilities are not separated into general and investigative, and there are only 7 of them. And this is because the adventures are only 2 to 3 hours long, and the meta currency economy that in core, you and I feel like when we talk about this, I wind up using the word core Gumshoe. You don't like that word, but like in other Gumshoe games, you have this this metacurrency economy that is based around making spends and rolling D6s and on making investigative spends. And what I have found over years of playtesting, you know, this game in its final form looks very different than it did when I first started tinkering with it. What I found is that the metacurrency economy wasn't working for like a 2-hour experience. And I just needed to tighten everything way the heck down. And this is what came out of it. And so now there's only 7 abilities. And all of these abilities function in ways that veteran Gumshoe players will recognize as being like, oh, it works like this. That's like a general ability. And it works like that. And that's like an investigative ability. And it's all, you know, I wouldn't want to use these mechanics for a game with some real sprawl to it. Something like, say, Eternal Lies for Trail. But for these tightly focused experiences, yeah, it's 7 abilities. They work differently from what you expect.
Right. And just if anyone is wondering, the reason I would say baseline Gumshoe instead of core Gumshoe is I'm already using the core for two other concepts. So the core activity of any game and the core clues. So, and I think baseline is a little better because it implies there's a less value judgment in that, because I think it's super exciting that you've gone so far away from the baseline and have created our Gumshoe Labs game. So the thing about Ballot Hunters, and a thing that we're kind of running into as we try to, for example, work out what, you know, the cover should be and so forth, is that Ballot Hunters is kind of its own genre, or I guess really like it's gritty historical fantasy. So I guess it's its own subgenre. But when people heard you describe the core activity of the game at the top of this segment, nobody was going, oh, that old thing, right? It's very unique. So what were the challenges of conveying such a different concept and getting your game from your head onto the page?
So the core challenge is exactly what you specified, right? You tell people, hey, this is a game set in the Regency era, but it's not like a fancy Jane Austen balls and you know, high couture Regency. It's regular people. It's farmers. It's coal miners. It's underpaid laborers. So you start with that.
There's like only one movie we could think of that's even set in this milieu, like Mike Leigh's Peterloo. Like the reference points are hard to find.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I wound up doing to solve this was rigorous playtesting, not only of mechanics, but of read aloud text and a tutorial adventure. So the book comes with, I want to say, 13 pre-written adventures, complete with, you know, the child ballad and here's how it comes to life and here's all your GMCs and here's all your stuff and, you know, just ready to run out of the box. And then also, in addition to that, 12 more child ballads ready for you to make your own adventures based on them for, you know, what works at your table and what your players enjoy. But one of these pre-made adventures is very explicitly a tutorial adventure. The book repeatedly emphasizes, hey, play this one first. If you're going to play Ballad Hunters as a one-shot, play this adventure. If you are starting a campaign, great, start it with this adventure. And that tutorial adventure is set up such that it walks players and GMs through Ballad Hunters. It does this to a certain extent with read aloud text, right? A lot of play testing of the read aloud text. You try running an adventure with one set of read aloud text to explain what's going on and how the players can interact with the world and, you know, what they can do and what might happen. And then the players ask you some questions and you know, real quick note down like, the players still had these questions. The read aloud text did not answer this. And so you keep iterating on that. But then the other thing that the tutorial adventure does is it's very intentional about what sorts of obstacles it puts in front of the party and in what order, so that the players kind of gradually learn the game, in many cases without even realizing that that's what they're doing. And also the GM is learning the game in doing this, because they don't have to the GM doesn't feel like they have to absorb the entire concept of ballad hunters right out of the gate. The GM is allowed to kind of flex their GM muscles in a more limited situation that gradually expands and gets more complicated as the tutorial adventure concludes. And I think that the highest compliment I have been paid in the course of playtesting this was by a very well-regarded designer named Ash Kreider, who played the tutorial adventure, which was being run by someone else while I was in the room silently taking notes at Metatopia in New Jersey. And at the end, Ash told me, you know, Tristan, I really don't think that this is as like complicated and weird as you think it is. And to a certain extent, that is because Ash Kreider is very smart and good at things. But also, I took it as like, okay, this tutorial adventure really is at this point, and at that point it was very refined, really is very gradually walking players and GMs through the experience of ballad hunters so that they get to the end and say, oh, that was a lot of fun, and I never really felt overwhelmed by it, which was my intent.
So I can tell as you've been preparing for the Kickstarter, which you can find by going to Kickstarter and searching either for ballad hunters or Pellegrin Press, and you'll find at least a sign-up page. I can tell that you've really honed your interviewing because you've incorporated the answers to a bunch of questions I then wound up getting to skip. So I'm going to hit you at the end here with one that I hope no one else has asked you, which is, which child ballad would you least want to come to life near you and why?
Oh my God, that's an easy answer, Robin. It's also one of my favorite child ballads, and it's one that's in the book. It's a child ballad called Lambkin. Lambkin is a wonderful song. It's deeply creepy. It's also not one of the standards. You'll find very few like professional recordings of folk musicians doing their version of Lambkin. The titular Lambkin, or Long Lambkin, is a mason who builds a castle for an English or Scottish, depending on your variant, lord. But the lord can't pay him. The lord doesn't have any money to pay the mason. And so Lambkin kind of retreats into the woods to brood and scheme. And the lord eventually, he is called to the capital. He tells his wife, you know, beware of Long Lambkin, for he is in the wood. Keep all the windows bolted. Keep all the doors locked. You know, watch out for Lambkin. And Lambkin left a secret passage in the castle. And he lets himself into the castle once the lord is gone. And he conspires with the lady's wet nurse, who is nursing the lord and lady's baby. And, oh, how will we get the lady to come down so that she can fall into our ambush? And the wet nurse stabs the baby with a pin. And there's this wonderful exchange where the lady and the wet nurse are calling to one another through the darkened castle. And eventually the lady comes down to her crying baby to quiet the crying baby. And who there but Long Lambkin to meet her in the dark? And she begs for her life. She begs for her infant's life. And Lambkin and the nurse instead conspire to kill her. And there's a bunch of really creepy imagery surrounding that. You know, oh, shall we collect her heart's blood in a bowl? You know, no, let it spill on the floor. What better is the heart's blood of the rich than the poor? And eventually the lord returns, discovers that his wife and his baby are dead. He catches Lambkin. He catches the false nurse. Both are executed. And like, it's a tragedy. It is a tragedy from beginning to end. Nothing in this is good. No one in this comes across well, except maybe the lady. And yeah, you want to ask which one would I not want to come into being around me? Lambkin. Easy answer.
Right. And it's still very contemporary because it's about a dispute with a contractor.
Yeah, absolutely. And honestly, that's one of the things that I really love about these child ballads that I think makes them still speak to us today is that they are ultimately about human experiences. They are about human emotions like, hey, I got stiffed on my contract and I'm really mad about it. You know, these are not emotional experiences that have left us. The songs are, you know, they describe a social milieu that is different now, but the emotional milieu is unchanged.
Well, as I said, you can check out the Kickstarter for this by going to Kickstarter and looking for Ballad Hunters, or just Pellegrin Press. So thanks a lot, Tristan, for joining us today.
No, thank you so much for having me. Real delight to be here.
The British are coming!
To the American South and the lands over the mountains in Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
Ken and Robin listeners can download a free PDF copy of the core rules from nationsandcannons.com using code KenRobin.
And educators can get a physical copy for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West, with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
Salvage the rebels' foreign alliances in Haiti and Spanish New Orleans.
Recover a mysterious map from Daniel Boone.
Sail into the heart of darkness, investigating George Rogers Clark's strange conquest of Vincennes.
Escape when all seems lost at Savannah and Charleston.
Fight the guerrilla war alongside the Swamp Fox in a fast-moving hex crawl.
And save the revolution at the climax at Yorktown.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at YourDadWillLoveThis.com. The whirring of chronotons and the clacking of time gears saw us were once more standing in proximity to Ken's time machine. This, of course, is the conveyance that our chrono hero uses to go back into history to bend, fold, spindle, and sometimes, yes, even mutilate it. And this time around, he does so at the behest of estimable Patreon backer Sam Harris, who opposes the following. Beloved idealist Sam Phillips of Sun Records apparently tried to mend fences between the U.S. and Cuba in the Bay of Pigs missile crisis era by calling up Raul Castro and trying to get through to Fidel. How would Cuba, America, the Cold War, and popular music have been different if Sam Phillips had managed to broker hemispheric peace in the early 1960s? So, Ken, tell us about this moon-spackled idealist, Sam Phillips.
Yeah. Sam Phillips, born in 1923 in Florence, Alabama. He's the eighth son of a big family of sharecroppers, fundamentally. He spends his time in the fields, says, that's not for me, and eventually winds up with a series of odd jobs at radio stations. He opens the Memphis Recording Service in 1950, where people can come in and record stuff. So, you know, birthday greetings, whatever, also songs. The song part of it becomes successful enough that he found Sun Records in 1952. In 1954, a young fella named Elvis Presley comes into Sun Records and records some songs. And Sam says, the upbeat one I can sell. And stop doing so many ballads, Elvis. Elvis records a bunch of singles for Sun Records. Sam realizes that Elvis is bigger than Sun Records can handle, so he basically holds an auction amongst the various big record companies. Elvis, he demands $40,000, which is an unheard of amount of money, but RCA Victor says, I think we can make that back on Elvis, and pays it. And so that's 1955.
Right. And he takes the proceeds from that and invests that in a scrappy new startup, a hospitality company called Holiday Inn. And that lays the foundation for Sam Phillips' actual considerable personal fortune. That was a sizable chunk of change and an amount to invest in the mid-50s. But it's his investment at Holiday Inn and his other business ventures that wind up making him an extremely wealthy man. So the question of what effect this has on popular music, well, he's kind of out of the popular music business in 1961 because he's sold Elvis's contract. So Sun Records is sort of a mere glimmer of its old self, its peak from like about 5-6 years prior. It's re-releasing its past stars, Jerry Lee Lewis, Roy Orbison, Johnny Cash, sometimes finding new material in the vault that they own to release from those artists. But the new material that it's releasing are by such obscure acts as the organist Shirley Sisk and the sax-based instrumental combo Wade Cagle and the Escorts. And I bet not many of us have those in our Spotify playlists. So The pop music part of Sam's career is kind of in the rearview mirror, but Ken, that just gives him an opportunity for diplomacy.
More time for the diplomacy. And this story is, as far as Phillips's biographer, Peter Guralnick, can ascertain, is true. Guralnick talked to not just other people who knew Phillips, but talked to the secretary of Sun Records at the time. And she said, yeah, we got a crazy phone bill. And I asked Sam about it and he told me. So this is the story of the crazy phone bill. So right after the Bay of Pigs invasion in April of 1961, Sam Phillips, according to his own testimony, had a few drinks and called Castro to straighten this out. In his own words, I mean, the Bay of Pigs was the stupidest damn thing in the whole wide world. Here was Castro, not only one of the smartest people on the earth, but one of the bravest. I guess it was about 8:30, 9:30 at night. They kept me on the line so long, getting a little more information, a little more information. Finally, they put me through, and I just knew I had Fidel. But actually, it was Raul, his brother. This was a great conversation, a fun conversation. I explained to Raul that I was just another person that was concerned. I wasn't in sympathy with communism. I wasn't in sympathy with democracy. I was in sympathy with common sense and people. Well, being from Alabama, he may not have seen a lot of democracy.
Right.
I didn't know if I could do a thing. And certainly I was not going to embarrass our government, but I was not going to back off my belief in how badly Cuba needed us and we needed Cuba. Everybody's going to say I'm a communist. I don't care. I'm an American through and through. But I was not going to back off on what I believe.
A proud, drunk American.
Right. And don't think for one cotton-picking minute that I wouldn't have gone over there if the State Department would have permitted me, which they probably wouldn't, and I would not have broken the law. But I sure would have done some talking as to why they should let me go. Let me fail. Let me fail as a citizen. So, you know, I quoted this at length because... And there's bits that I cut out just because it's too wonderful and too perfect, but right. This is Sam.
But clearly he would have succeeded if he'd gone. We can tell from that paragraph.
Well, you listen to this reminiscence of a drunken ramble, and this is the guy who's going to talk Castro around, clearly. So anyway, I think that, to put it bluntly, this is a multi-bank shot of a time change. First of all, there has to be some notion that Castro can be talked out of Soviet client statehood in 1961. Not as easy as it sounds, I feel.
Yeah, he's kind of bought in 61. That's a little late to talk about
right.
that.
So there's some sort of moving around that has to be done to get this situation. And again, I don't think we're going to be talking Castro out of being a communist. I think best case scenario, you lure him like Tito out of the Soviet orbit, and he's an independent communist state like Yugoslavia was. So that's your best case scenario, and I'm not 1,000,000% sure it's doable, but what the hell. So one of the things that there needs to be for the Kennedy administration to move on this topic is a little more popular sentiment that the Bay of Pigs is a wrong idea as opposed to just a blundering idea. And I feel the shortest road to that, or the road that's the most fun, is to just give Elvis just a little touch of soft on Cubanness, and that he and Sam, obviously they stay in touch. Maybe there's a little bit of Sam's working class Alabama idealism that bleeds into Elvis's good patriot self. But if you get him to meet up with the communist folk and blues singer Barbara Dane, and I don't believe they ever actually met, but obviously he respected her voice, but I don't think they ever actually met. In our timeline, she's in Berkeley in San Francisco in 1955, 1956. In 1958, she's invited to Chicago at the Gate of Horn, Chicago's premier slash only folk club. In 1958, she's singing with Memphis Slim, and I feel like Memphis Slim maybe is a connection with Sam Phillips and with Elvis. But if we get her invited to Chicago a year early, maybe she's in Chicago when Elvis plays the International Amphitheater in March of 1957. And maybe, you know, she opens for him or whatever. She's got a great blues voice. Elvis, of course, has a huge fascination with the blues. And looking at pictures of Barbara Dane, she's a very attractive woman, but I don't think she's Elvis's type. But I feel like there could maybe be a little bit of affinity based on, you know, she has a very maternal energy, and I think Elvis responds to that as well. So I think that it's not outside the realm of possibility that Elvis and Barbara Dane are friends. And then as Bay of Pigs goes down, he says, what do you think about that, Barbara? And she says, well, I think it's awful to do that to Castro. And maybe there's a little more sentiment in the pre-hippie era for hitting the brakes a little bit on the communists. Other soft on Castro figures in the White House included William Atwood and Gordon Chase after 1962, and National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy. And that, I think, is one of our windows in. And in our timeline, in 1963, after the missile crisis, this was October of 62, JFK did indeed tentatively try a sweet approach to Castro to try and lure him out of Soviet orbit. And Bundy was a big proponent of that, as was Chase and Atwood. In our history, that was too little too late. And one assumes Castro is saying, you're also trying to kill me. Make up your mind, dumbass.
Yeah, lay off the exploding cigars while you're at
right.
it.
Right. So the thesis is that thanks to the softening of youth opposition to Castro, McGeorge Bundy is a little louder in the National Security Council. And so Kennedy, who of course famously sort of went along with whatever the experts told him for a while, would be talkable into blaming the Bay of Pigs on Eisenhower, getting out from under it that way, and then saying, now is the time after that foolishness is over that we need to, you know, try the sweet approach. So we sort of short circuit Mongoose and we go right into the sweet approach in 61. And it is at this moment that Sam Phillips gives Kennedy the great opening. And they say, sure, Sam Phillips, why don't you go to Cuba? That'll be great. And again, that when Kennedy was doing the sweet approach, he did send civilians. Then he sent more connected civilians like Atwood. Then he sent RFK Jr. to Cuba. Not well known, but there we are. So that was part of the Kennedy approach, was sort of this around the corner type way. But Sam Phillips, State Department says, sure, go on ahead, Sam Phillips. And while we're dreaming, Sam can talk Castro into reopening the nightclubs. Because, of course, one of the things Castro did was shut all the nightclubs, throwing all Cuban musicians out of work. And so if we reopen even a few of the nightclubs, then son, the Cuban music that is the foundation of Buena Vista social club type stuff, that comes back into Cuba. We don't wait 25 years for it to return. And Sam Phillips thinks, well, these guys are cheap. I can buy them up. And Sun Records starts being Son Records as well. And so you get a big Cuban influx, not just Tito Puente and Celia Cruz and the sort of anti-Castro Cuban musicians, but also the more don't believe in democracy, don't believe in communism type Cuban music that Sam Phillips would have been recruiting. Now, the downside to this beautiful influx of son into the 60s soundscape and Elvis being like, hold on there, let's not have any nuclear Armageddon. You do have Kennedy being pilloried now for being soft on communism. And so he has to ramp up his aggressive response in Laos and Vietnam to keep Goldwater, who is by now the putative Republican candidate, from making hay out of this approach to Cuba. And so, you know, the Cold War maybe hots up a little bit in Asia, although, again, I looked into it, and Berlin is a little bit too early, the Berlin Wall crisis. So I don't think that Kennedy's going to change much about Berlin. I don't think he's going to send the tank corps down the highway the way that the Pentagon was sort of asking him to do. So I think we still get the Berlin Wall, but I definitely think we get American troops in Laos openly, as opposed to the secret war that we had anyway. And we probably accelerate our approach to Vietnam, and maybe even go along with one of the proposals for direct action against North Vietnam that Kennedy tabled. So possible changes to the Vietnam War, definite changes to American popular music, and gives Sam Phillips one last burst of career success. And it may make Elvis a bit of a socialist, a bit of a pink, but Elvis will stay good and true and patriotic, and I'm sure nothing bad will ever happen to him.
Well, I got to say, that's a timeline that is not in sympathy with communism and isn't in sympathy with democracy. It's just
right.
an ever so slightly different timeline. So I guess if you ever want to write a novel that is distinguished by a alternate reality that is only 10% alternate, I think feel free to steal this segment for that purpose.
Yeah, you have your characters going to the Tropicana in Havana and playing with Elvis on tour because I tried so hard to get Tom Parker out of this timeline. I don't know that I could, but maybe you don't need a passport to go to Cuba in this under the old Platt Amendment, and you can still go.
Well, I think that gives us our passport out of this episode, but a mere week from today, we'll use our documentation to get right back in. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Join the chorus of proud backers such as...
Ian Carlson.
James Stewart.
Andrea Coletta.
Yaj from Edinburgh.
And Drew Eichels.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time, and once again, we will talk about stuff.